here today, but I appreciate everyone coming. I think in light of that, I'm going to probably speak extemporaneously a few points, if you'll forgive me, and maybe skip a bit of heavier material partly in the interest of time, and perhaps work that into a future talk. I have a long-standing philosophical interest in questions of truth, as well as in the psychology and behavioral economics of factors I've kind of referred to as the cognitive biases that can hamper our ability to discern the truth, both in making economic decisions, but perhaps more importantly, in making many sorts of decisions. And I'll go more into that in detail in a little bit. I also, a couple of years ago, had the wonderful opportunity to work part-time as a speech and debate coach for young people in high school, not having been a debater myself, and that taught me more clearly about principles of argumentation and things like logical fallacies. And also, in spite of the fact that I have a lot of training and sometimes even giving classes and interpersonal and organizational communications, debate really honed in for me the importance of listening. And that was one of the very first things that I would tell then debaters, is to work on your listening skills, because it's certainly impossible to have a good argument and absolutely impossible to win a greater debate unless the debaters listen carefully to their opponents and address their opponents' arguments, because otherwise they were just giving a speech and it wasn't a debate. And that's a point that we'll get into before long as well. But particularly given that background, it's been challenging, if not distressing, to watch what's going on in the environment of late. It seems like the coming to a head of many little things that have bothered me for a long time, where all of a sudden there seems a widespread disregard for the truth, the use of almost cult-like reinvented language about alternative truth and things like that that are actually far from it. Though there are some legitimate arguments underlying that. But to get to the meat of the things, the subject of my topic today is our fourth UU principle, which is in full a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. At the beginning of January, Reverend Barber gave a sermon on the quest for truth. She referred to how, in the unison covenant that we repeat at the beginning of every service, the quest for truth is the sacrament of this church, echoing that denominational principle of ours. She reminded us that it is the quest itself that we hold sacred, not preordained truth, or even necessarily attaining truth. And she challenged us to take seriously the responsibility that comes with the search for truth, and to not allow ourselves to get too carried away with the freedom. Finally, she gave us some criteria for determining if we're seeking responsibly, and if the truth we find is responsible. Today, I want to examine a bit more in detail our responsibility to truth, and how best to responsibly pursue truth, particularly in light of recent events and the so-called post-truth political climate. More than ever, we need to be able to bridge divides between ourselves and others and come to agreement about how to move forward, especially when truth itself is at issue. I'd even like to think this is one of the issues in the 21st century for which Unitarian Universalism is perhaps uniquely suited to position. Any quest for truth starts with ourselves and has dimensions that can be transformative and even spiritual. Authentic searching and seeking has to begin with the understanding that we operate based on assumptions and beliefs, and that we need to be open to examining those, even challenging them, and possibly having them disproven in the search for something greater. That requires compassion and empathy for ourselves and not just others. There are a number of good recent guides to civil discourse, but rather than go down a particular complete list of points, I want to focus on a few key principles and practices. The quest for truth and for dialogue starts with preparation, not only internal reflection and the cultivation of open-mindedness, but when possible, factual preparation. It's important for us not only to understand our own position, its logical structure and factual basis, so that we can explain it and defend it, but also to understand the opposing side, not just that we can challenge it, but to appreciate the worldview that underlies it, and to know where there might be points of agreement. Good listening is actually the start of any good discussion or debate. We need to really understand the other person, or the other side, to be able to respond. But putting ourselves in a receptive listening mode also sets the atmosphere for collaboration, and even possible reconciliation. It is here that compassion and empathy for others comes into play. Next, it's important to let the other side explain themselves, not only so that we can fully understand them, but also because that can put them in a reflective frame of mind as well. Particularly when we have listened well and can then ask questions, there is an opportunity to elicit more than just statements of position. The same research and conversation guides that tell us that confronting an opinion or belief can actually cause defensiveness and hardening, but when someone is actually having to think through their position rather than just stating it, they may be open to reconsideration. One interesting additional tool of dialogue along those lines, which is actually used in dealing with a situation in which individuals have been indoctrinated, is to ask the person to go back to when they adopted their stance and what it was they were looking for and valued that led them down the path that it has. Then, when truth is at issue, one helpful approach that is often used in mediation and negotiation is to agree to refer to an outside authority, whether a fact-checking website, scientific research, or the Congressional Budget Office. But here is where we start to encounter the counterintuitive traps of the human mind. One thing we know from research, and can probably observe in the present atmosphere, is that when issues are contentious, even accurate information can be discounted. So now I'd like to explore that and other challenges a bit more in depth. I want to end with addressing what I call some tools for truth, which are covered in the handout. These apply as much, if not more so, to our own thinking and presuppositions as to those of others. But to begin with, logical fallacies are errors in thinking and logic that have long been known. One of the most famous of these, with many implications, is the straw man argument, which involves misrepresenting someone else's argument and then attacking the misrepresentation. The classic religious example of this is when Jesus knocked over the tables of the money changers in the temple as an example of reform, and the Pharisees then accused him of trying to destroy the temple. Then there are the cognitive biases being revealed by psychological and behavioral research, errors in evaluating information to which we are inherently prone. Basically, these are understood to have evolved as part of mankind's early reliance on living in collaborative hunter-gatherer groups, where information evaluation and decision-making that were skewed from an individual perspective supported survival of the group. More so than logical fallacies, these can be complex, sometimes overlap one another, occasionally overlapping logical fallacies as well, and are the subject of ongoing research. One very relevant one that is not specifically on the handout is escalation of commitment, known in economics as sunk costs. Sunk costs. into something. This has long been known by the old phrase, throwing good money after bad. It's typified by our tendency to continue investing in something like an old car, even when starting fresh would occasionally be a better use of resources. And sometimes referred to by a popular phrase as doubling down on something. Another important one, number 9 on the side of the handout with cognitive biases, is confirmation bias. This involves not only the excess weight we give to information that confirms our preconceptions, but all, as we also now see around us, extends to seeking out sources of information that fit our biases as well. Those tools are something I'd ask you to consider, but they, and going into that in depth with themselves, would be entirely another talk, if not a talk on logical fallacies, and then a talk on cognitive biases. So for the time being, I'm going to leave you with that handout, which I hope will be helpful and of interest to you. I'm sure that some of those are familiar, but I always discover every time I go down the list something that I myself have fallen into or failed to catch fairly recently. So to recap, it's important to connect with and to be persuasive with those who believe differently or who frame things differently. Perhaps one of our great challenges is not in finding natural allies, an ally of those with whom we sympathize, but in discovering ways to communicate and collaborate with others for whom we have the least affinity. Our belief in searching for truth as Unitarians, I think, again, puts us in a particularly good, if not unique, position because we hold to the quest and not to specific beliefs and dogma. It might be a little bit too much of a stretch to connect the theme of rebirth of today's religious holiday to the theme of questing for truth, but I would like to think that perhaps in the 21st century that we as Unitarians and that we as an American people and as a worldwide community have an opportunity to really seek a rebirth in our truth seeking and in our commitment to truth, even when it is inconvenient or uncomfortable. I think for today, I'm going to leave it at that and take any questions that you have or comments that you have.
Thank you so much for that talk, and thank you for the handout. I am really looking forward to digging into this. I just wanted to make a comment. I've been going to this church since I moved here in 2007, but from 2009 to 2012, I took a temporary hiatus to go to a Baptist church because my then husband was a member of that church, and I remember going through this group called the Truth Project, and the congregation got together at the pastor's church after church, and basically kind of felt like I was being brainwashed in into believing their version of what the truth is. And I remember there was a video that they showed, and they were asking different people from different areas what they thought truth was. And one of those people was a Unitarian minister, and she said, truth is relative. And after we watched the film, the pastor went around and said, so what did you get out of that film? And I said, truth is relative. And that was not a good answer. but I've always believed that truth is relative.
I was just reading about Elon Musk recently because he's accomplished so much and he's kind of an oddball. And it's like, how is he so effective? Well, aside from working 100 hours a week and being a genius, what part of his secret sauce is that he thinks of everything from first principles. He kind of throws conventional wisdom out the window. And part of doing that, I mean, I was looking at these cognitive biases, and I think thinking from first principles is, looking at the evidence and trying to think your way around everything, you know, on this list. And I think he does that particularly effectively, and that's how he's able to accomplish what he has.
This past week, I had a long discussion with an artist friend of mine who's kind of working through the dilemma of facts, the separation between facts, truth, and constructs. And, you know, he's really got me thinking at this particular point about the idea of constructs. That in particular, my mind is starting to deal with the issue of how we construct our own truth based upon the filtering of particular facts for a particular situation. And that's primarily what she was speaking about over here.
That's interesting what you just said. I just was thinking about it, someone talking about imagining different dimensions, for instance, when they're talking about, different things with physics or something, they're like, well, think about it, what you experience, like a bug thinks that there are only two dimensions, as you're watching it, you're observing it walking on a piece of paper, and it can only, it's on only that dimension, so you only know what, your experience is. That's what makes you, what I think of when we talk about constructs, but anyway, JP, I appreciate this. This is really some really good tools. I think it's so easy to just identify with people we agree with. And especially right now, there's a lot of divisive issues out there. So it's a really good reminder to listen, try to maybe agree with someone that you don't agree with, to question where the kind of facts came from, and both kind of agree to look at the sources and so I think these are some really good reminders for civil conversations. So thanks.
Kind of a different take on this, coming from wherever. Where else would you think my comments would come from? Sophie, the therapy girl, got a new hospice patient last week, and this individual. It's living in a reality that is completely her own, and which I think Sophie maybe penetrated a little bit, but I didn't. It was a kind of a profound experience for me that I'm still coming to grips with, because it was so much more than other patients that we have seen over the past year, but things were happening in this person's mind that were in another place completely, but were there. It was interesting. And also, when you handed this thing out, the first thing that struck my eye was stereotyping, and that really hit me because
because I think in the work that I do, or even in the work that I do, I think we're all stereotyped, but somebody with a particular diagnosis, and you think, okay, this is the way it's going to be, and yet they're still individuals, and they live out their diagnosis in unique ways.
This is very timing for me, JP, and I love the scene. This is great. It's timely because I'm teaching two effective speaking classes at Castleton, and I really appreciate what you said early on in your talk about how important listening is, because most of the students that I work with are between 18 and 21-ish, and for many of them, coming into effective speaking is really the first time, it appears, that they've ever come across the idea that it's important to listen to other people to inform yourself about how you might address them. And at the end of the semester, I always have students write reflective paper on what they learned in the course, and that's always one of the things students talk about at length, is how it was the first time they ever thought about how important it is to listen to other people before you know really what you want to say in response. And we're coming up to debates. We're about to give short persuasive speeches, and then the next week we'll be working on debates. And again, it's the first time students often have ever thought about how there are equally valid ways to argue for different points of view or different truths. And one of the things that students often learn in the process of debates also is something that you kind of acknowledge, which is that often in explaining their point of view, they often find that by the end of the debate, they kind of converted to the other side, you know. And for some of them, that's a really horrible experience because they feel like they're giving up something that they believe forever. You know? Anyway, this is really interesting. Thank you.
It's good for them.
So shall we continue our discussion over coffee?
Let me make a quick additional note. You know, one of the things, I look at something like that handout and I think that logical fallacies are something that everybody in school should learn about, and that cognitive biases, and especially ones that apply to economics, which a lot of them do, like economic decisions, are things that, you know, ought to be taught in a financial literacy class, which sometimes exists, but once again, it's probably a whole other thing that we like to cover in school. And one of the things that I'm fairly convinced of is that one reason that we don't have that is pushback from forces whose beliefs that would challenge, and we don't want very many people talk critical thinking. And I think of that in terms of the vast conspiracy, exactly, but I think there's a lot of conservative influence that when such things might arise, dismiss it. And not to be too harsh on our fundamentalist friends, who I think we should try and understand better, and maybe to point out one way in which we can understand them better, but the New York Times article that I quoted had another additional quote in which they said that various sorts of religious fundamentalism are actually a forerunner of modern cultural relativism in the way that they can dismiss the empirical search for truth. And I think it's one of the real balances that we have to seek, to which there are not easy answers, is though we can we have to recognize that ultimate truth may be unattainable, but that doesn't mean we can throw up our hands and say, well, everything is okay, everything is equal, because it's not. There is a process for seeking some degree of principles and bases for action that are at least closer to the truth and more based on fact, even if they're not as exact as we desire. And I think that that's important, and some of what we're seeing in the current political and social environment is, in fact, the whiplash of a certain sort of relativism. Thank you. I have a quote from Albert Einstein. Being from Einstein, it's a little bit dense, so I'm going to read it twice and slowly. And this is a quote. I found it, and I practically feel like Einstein is talking using the terms. Even though the realms of religion and science in themselves are clearly marked off from each other, nevertheless, there exists between the two strong reciprocal relationships and dependencies. Though religion may be that which determines the goal, it has, nevertheless, learned from science in the broadest sense what means will contribute to the attainment of the goals it has set up. But science can only be created by those who are thoroughly imbued with the aspiration toward truth and understanding. The source of feeling, however, springs from the sphere of religion. To this there also belongs the faith in the possibility that the regulations valid for the world of existence are rational, that is, comprehensible to reason. I cannot conceive of a genuine scientist without that profound faith. The situation may be expressed by an image. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. And again, even though the realms of religion and science in themselves are clearly marked off from each other, nevertheless there exists between the two strong reciprocal relationships and dependencies. Though religion may be that which determines the goal, it has nevertheless learned from science, in the broadest sense, what means will contribute to the attainment of the goals it has set up. But science can only be created by those who are thoroughly imbued with the aspiration for truth and understanding. This source of feeling, however, springs from the sphere of religion. To this there also belongs the faith in the possibility that the regulations valid for the world of existence are rational, that is, comprehensible to reason. I cannot conceive of a genuine scientist without that profound faith. The situation may be expressed by an image. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is dead.
Please join me in extinguishing the chalice. The words are in your order of service. We extinguish the flame.